from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, many in this country still struggle to get mental health care. The most recent federal data finds some 43 million Americans live with depression, anxiety, or other mental health conditions. Yet more than half the people who needed help in 2014 never got it. Even with the Affordable Care Act and more people having insurance, the gap persists. We look at why it's so hard to access mental health services, even here in the Bay Area, where there's an abundance of therapists. That's all next on Forum. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. It's a strange paradox in this country that the more you need mental health care, the harder it seems it is to get. With the Affordable Care Act, more people have insurance, and insurers have increasingly been required to include mental health coverage in their plans. Yet many in California still struggle to find available therapists that they can afford. That's what KQED's health reporter April Demboski discovered after spending months looking at the experiences of people trying to access mental health services in the Bay Area and other parts of the state. In this hour Forum, we'll talk with April and experts in the mental health care field about why this gap persists and what people are trying to do about it. Let me tell you who's joining us. Keith Humphreys is professor of psychiatry at the Stanford School of Medicine. He's a research scientist also with the Veterans Affairs Palo Alto Healthcare System. Good morning, Keith Humphreys.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Thanks for being here. We're also joined by Bart McGee. He's a psychologist and the executive director of Access Institute for Psychological Services. Its mission is to provide a mental health safety net for those without adequate insurance. Good morning, Bart McGee.
Good morning.
And we also have, of course, April Demboski, KQED's health reporter, also a reporter with the California Report. And April, I want to start by actually playing a little bit from one of your stories. The first is a story that you did about a mother in San Diego who claims Kaiser Permanente failed to take care of her daughter's mental health needs. Let's listen to the clip first, and then we can talk about it.
Maria Spivey is a bus driver in San Diego. She was driving this route down El Cajon Boulevard one day in March 2 years ago when her cell phone kept ringing and ringing. She figured it was her 17-year-old daughter, Chloe.
And I'm dead center, 42nd in El Cajon Boulevard. There's no way I could stop and answer the phone. And so I just keep going. I was like, when I get to the end of the line, I'll take a break, I'll call Chloe.
When she got to the terminal, the calls became more insistent. Now it was her partner, Charles.
He's like, well, you need to get home. I was like, you know, I don't like surprises. And he's like, no, just get home, please. Get home now.
She rushed home. Cop cars were parked in every direction outside her house.
And Charles opens my door and he's telling me, Chloe's gone. I'm like, Chloe's gone? Like, where'd she go? Oh, he's like, no, she's gone.
Chloe had killed herself. She was found hanging in the garage.
And I think I almost fell to my knees, but I didn't want to lose complete control. My kids were watching me.
At first, Spivey blamed herself, but then she blamed Kaiser Permanente. Spivey says the HMO failed to take care of her daughter.
That's April Demboski reporting for her series State of Mind on Access to Mental Health Care. April, that's very powerful, very sad. And I wanted to start with that because in some ways it was also the impetus for your own reporting in terms of what we heard a lot about in terms of Kaiser patients having a hard time getting therapy appointments, especially in 2014.
That's right. Back in 2014 and 2015, there was a lot of action around this, particularly on the part of mental health clinicians who worked at Kaiser. They were also in a contract battle with Kaiser. And so they were really raising the alarm that, you know, they were overworked. They didn't have enough time to see all the patients that wanted to see them. They said, you know, Kaiser's understaffing the department. We need more help so that we can see patients in a timely manner. Some people were waiting 4 to 6 weeks for appointments. And a lot of people said that they had been pushed into group therapy instead of one-on-one. And that was the case with Maria Spivey's daughter. She, Kaiser actually told them there was no one-on-one therapy.
And this also, made headlines because the Department of Managed Health Care, the state's regulator of health insurers, actually fined Kaiser $4 million.
They did. And that was the second largest fine that the DMHC has levied against an insurer.
Now, since then, Kaiser has been addressing the problem.
Absolutely. Kaiser has been, they've been talking about how they've been hiring hundreds more therapists. They've been, looking at their data, trying to find ways to address the problem. They are involved in medical schools. They said they're trying to kind of get in on the ground level to help train more mental health clinicians so that they enter the field.
But this whole thing made you say to yourself, Kaiser can't be the only one.
Exactly. One of the explanations that was offered at the time by one of the executives at Kaiser about why they were having so much trouble was that they were saying, well, there's a shortage of healthcare providers. There's a shortage of mental health care providers. And while there is literature that supports that, it just in the Bay Area, that just didn't make sense to me. And so I wanted to look into it. And the more I looked into it, I found just to me a very surprising number of therapists who didn't take insurance at all. And so I figured, all right, well, if Kaiser is having trouble, finding therapists who are willing to work for them, and therapists are complaining about how insurance companies don't pay enough, then there's got to be an issue with there being enough therapists who actually take insurance. And that's exactly what I found out.
And Keith Humphreys with Stanford School of Medicine, you're a professor of psychiatry there. This is something that you've seen as well as you've looked at the field.
Yeah, it's very painful. I have to say to me personally, I worked with Congress on the 2008 mental health parity law, and I was in the White House under President Obama when the Affordable Care Act passed, which were supposed to address this very problem. And in terms of the letter of the law, people have better access to mental health than they've ever had. But as April's reporting has showed, in practice, it often doesn't work out that way, either because the insurer doesn't follow the law or therapists don't want to take the insurance. And we're an affluent part of the country. There's a lot of people who will pay cash for therapy. And that pulls a lot of people out of the insured market. So we have the contradiction of there's an awful lot of mental health professionals in the Bay Area, and yet it's still hard to find one when you have insurance.
And is that why Bart McGee, when April was talking about this perceived shortage of, mental health providers, that you were shaking your head, that there is this contradiction, that in fact there are a lot of therapists?
Yeah, there are a lot of therapists, and there are a lot of therapists that are really wanting to provide service. But a lot of it is the fact that the reimbursement rates are so low, and they haven't risen in decades.
What are the rates, April Domboski?
On average, I heard, about $60 or $80 for a 50-minute session.
And yeah, so the going rate now, Bart McGee?
Well, when you think about, the going rate for private practice therapy is closer to $200. And you got to think that, therapists have to pay all of their overhead expenses out of that. I mean, that is an hour session. They also have to make time to make notes, to make return phone calls. So when you add it all up, it's really not adequate. So this is why a lot of therapists say, well, we're not going to take insurance. The other problem, I think, is that there is a kind of bias in the system because you've got this private practice model that oftentimes just isn't set up to serve enough people. So there are so many people that end up in the gap. I mean, Access Institute was founded because people didn't have insurance. And so we were trying to provide an affordable option for them. But now we see the same problem. The other thing is that with the bronze plans that many people have, the lower cost affordable,
under the state's healthcare market,
or under the Affordable Care Act plans, many of them, they require you to meet your deductible, which can be thousands of dollars. So that means that a low-income person would have to pay $200 a session for many months before their insurance kicks in. Many of those people end up coming to us because we'll provide the therapy at an affordable rate. So it's another problem. I mean, there's so many problems with this.
And you're talking about the plans under Covered California.
Yes.
Besides the way that the system is structured, it seemed that you found, April Domboski, that even when there were insurers with, dozens of therapists in a network that people who are trying to make appointments with them were having a really hard time.
And that's a little bit what Bart was getting at, is that a lot of therapists are in private practice. They work for themselves, and so they don't have an administrative assistant or an office manager who can take their calls for them. So they're seeing clients, you know, all day, hour by hour, and then in between, you know, in that 10-minute period, you know, between 5:50 and 6 p.m. is when they have time to call people back. And so, you know, if your practice is full, then, and, you know, you're getting some therapists told me they get 20 calls a week from people asking for therapy, and there's just no way that they can call all of them back. And so that's what I found. I mean, I ended up calling a bunch of therapists, and half of them never called me back.
Well, let's talk about why you were calling a bunch of therapists. So you had met a woman who described herself as lower middle class by the skin of her teeth. And, you know, at first she was unable to access mental health services, though she had insurance, because the copay for mental health care was actually double what it would be for a regular office visit. And Keith Humphries, you're saying that that's illegal now?
Yes, that's what the parity law was supposed to correct, that you couldn't offer your benefits for mental health at a lower rate than for everything else. That's not supposed to happen.
And how are insurers still able to do it then?
Well, first off, the regulatory fight about the parity law went on 5 or 6 years. So, you know, advocates go home and lobbyists stay in Washington. So often it's how the regulation is written. And then it takes a lot of enforcement right. to back it up. Now, California is actually better than most states. New York is very good. But a lot of states, they don't put much effort into enforcing the law, and then insurers can kind of do what they want to do.
And then this woman got Blue Shield, and her copay for a mental health visit was $20, much more affordable, and she tried to make an appointment with a therapist. What happened?
She called about 6 or 7. About half called them back, kind of consistent with my results. And then the ones who did call her back said they weren't accepting the insurance anymore or didn't have space in their schedule. So, you know, after 6 or 7 calls, you know, she was feeling depressed, didn't have a lot of energy, and just gave up.
So you decided then to try calling every single psychologist in her network, and there were 100 of them.
Right. So it was 100 that showed up in the search results. So I'm sure there are probably more in the network. But so I took that 100 number, and I called all of them.
And how long did that take, and what happened?
I did it probably over the course of a month. And so, yeah, about half of them didn't call back. And about a quarter of them said they weren't taking new patients. And so about a quarter of them said they were. And then an additional question I asked was, well, do you have appointments in the evening? Because that's critical for someone like the woman that I profiled, and for a lot of people who don't necessarily have the freedom to take time off of work. And so only 8 out of 100 had an evening appointment available.
8 out of 100. You talked with insurance companies. What did they say? And I should say we did invite the Association or California Association of Health Plans to join us, but they were unable to. What did they tell you?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, they talk about the shortage and also the fact that, you know, with the Affordable Care Act passing, there are now millions more, about 4 or 5 million more Californians who have health coverage. And some reports indicate that some people who didn't have health insurance before was because they had been excluded for a pre-existing mental health condition. So there's some idea that there was some backlog, people waiting to get covered and find insurance. But they also talked about the fact that, you know, these are solo practitioners. Sometimes it can be very difficult to get them to keep up on their administrative, you know, tasks.
Because they're supposed to inform the
insurer. They're supposed to inform the insurer if there's some kind of change in their contact information or their availability. But let me be clear that as far as the law is concerned, the responsibility is on the plans to make sure that there are enough mental health providers.
And Keith Humphries, you've suggested that this is also just a way for companies, insurance companies, to cut costs. How?
Right. I mean, you know, when every time you pay a claim, that's money out the door, right? So you have, that's one of the things about it, when we have our for-profit-driven healthcare system is there's a basic conflict between the financial interests of companies and the needs of patients. And part of the problem is, you know, I think April illuminated very well, is it's at the moment when we're at our weakest that we have to fight those companies. So, you know, struggling with depression, I can't even get out of bed, and now I have to fill out 16 pages of forms and fight with a utilization review person, and I don't have the energy to do it. So they win a lot that way just by attrition.
Barbara, can I just jump in there too?
Yeah, sure.
It's not only that, but also that it, as a group, mental health patients they're not able to advocate in a way. And I think that's why we're seeing this problem with the low reimbursement rates. Think about this for a second. If the oncologists across the country all of a sudden say, you know what, these reimbursement rates are shameful. We can't take insurance anymore. So if you want your chemotherapy treatment, you're going to have to pay out of pocket. What would happen? You'd have a massive outcry. And those reimbursement rates would go back to what they are, what they should be. It would be very easy for insurance companies to attract more providers, to have providers who had space available if those rates were reasonable. Very simple.
Bart McGee, a psychologist and executive director of Access Institute, which provides mental health services for those without adequate insurance or those who are uninsured. We're also talking with April Demboski, health reporter for KQED, about her mental health series looking at access to mental health care, and Keith Humphreys, professor of psychiatry at Stanford School of Medicine. And Keith Humphreys, this brings me sort of to what feels like a question that overrides all of this, which is, why is mental health care not seen as crucial as physical health care? I mean, why do we not invest as much in mental health as we do in physical health?
Well, mental illness and addiction both have long been deeply stigmatized, going back, you know, to the founding of this country as something that is due to a sin or bad character, in a way that we just don't judge people who get cancer. And that, you know, cultural stigma is still with us today. I mean, it's less you can talk about having a therapist now at a party. You couldn't do that 50 years ago. It's less intense than it used to be. But there's still, you know, a sense that these aren't quite legitimate illnesses, or the people who have them aren't really good people. And we just don't owe them as much. And we don't respond to the same level of compassion. And in a group, you can really see this with his parents. You know, if a parent comes on TV and says, my kid has cancer, everyone's heart goes out to that parent. If he says, my kid is depressed, people start thinking, well, that must not be a very good parent. They probably did something wrong. I don't feel sorry for that person. Quite uncompassionate.
April, we're talking about barriers to accessing mental health on the insurance level, but you also found, you know, barriers that exist geographically. There's a new study that found barriers exist if you're a person of color or if you're somebody who is a working class person. Can you talk a little bit about that Princeton study that you recently reported on?
Sure. So there was a graduate student at Princeton who, in a very scientific way, called 320 psychotherapists in New York City. And what she did was she had voice actors, portray a patient, a prospective patient who is experiencing anxiety or depression. And so she divided them up to have, and she had kind of studied how to do this with accent and vocabulary so that the people calling could be clearly identified as, say, white middle class, black middle class, or working class, black or white. And she found some really interesting results in terms of who called back. So all her calls also got a pretty low callback rate in general. But in terms of class, if you are white middle class, one out of two of those callers got a response. One out of three of the working class callers got a call back. And then in terms of who was offered an appointment, the disparities were also greater. So 28% of white middle class callers were offered an appointment. 17% of black middle class callers were offered an appointment. And 8% of working class callers, black or white, were offered an appointment.
Keith Humphreys, what was your reaction to these findings? Does this, seem to parallel what you've been seeing in the industry?
You know, it makes me heartsick, you know, because they will often be the person with less resources who needs the help more. And it's a phenomenon in the American mental health system that doesn't exist, like, for example, in the, you know, our next-door neighbor, the Canadian health system, which is people who are less severe problems, who have more money, get a lot more mental health. They absorb a lot of mental health services. And you don't see that in other places. And they push out other people who can't pay as much and may be more troubled. And that's, you know, it always makes me sad about my field and sad about, you know, what happens to lower income people.
But in terms of the, you know, the issues with working with insurance companies, the lack of pay, it's hard to blame therapists for not wanting to work with a client population that's relatively high functioning and able to pay what they're asking.
Yeah, I mean, all these things have to be balanced, right? You know, I think of people in the VA and people that work for the county of Santa Clara, San Francisco County, who are mental health providers, and they are making less money because they really do believe in taking care of you know, the least of us. And I admire that. But there is some limit, you know, when we all have to pay our mortgages, that where, you know, goodwill can only go so far. And if you're losing 10% off what you might make, that's one thing. But if you're losing 50, 60, 70%, it's understandable that people are tempted to say, you know, enough, I want to go into this high-end, you know, cash-only market.
There's also the high cost of medical school.
Sure.
Are there a lot of loans that people walk out with? Bart McGee, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say something about that because that's part of our program. We train mental health professionals. And so I work with them every day. And so these are the graduate students coming out of school, and they are burdened with hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt. So we have another problem here, which is that people enter this field because they care. They want to help. I mean, you don't go into mental health because you're looking to make big bucks. I mean, it's just not what you're doing. But, you know, they come out of school and they start their practices and they start working. And, you know, the jobs in public mental health they pay very badly. And so if you go into private practice, even though you might have a desire to see, you know, people who are lower income and on a sliding scale, you know, you have your own financial – you've got your financial worries to contend with.
So, Bart McGee, who tends to come to the Access Institute to receive services, and who are the therapists who you work with?
Yeah, so, well, we serve people who are really in this broad gap. You know, there are really two mental health systems in this country. There's the private practice model that we've been talking about, and then there's the public model. And, you know, the public system is funded in California through Medi-Cal. And that serves, you know, people who are very poor. But, you know, for example, if you're in a public clinic and let's say you get a job, you're no longer eligible at that clinic. So then you're out. There's so many people, as I was saying, who are, you know, they're working people. They, you know, the average income of our patients is something like $25,000 a year. So these are lower income people who, again, they might have different kinds of coverage. Kaiser, we have a lot of Kaiser patients. So it's a big group of people that, you know, need this. And we need more programs like ours that really fill in this gap.
Bart McGee is Executive Director of Access Institute for Psychological Services. He's also a psychologist. We're talking with Keith Humphreys, Professor of Psychiatry at the Stanford School of Medicine, and April Dembosky, health reporter for KQED. We're looking at why people still struggle to access mental health services in this country, even with new laws and policies and new awareness of the importance of mental health care. And we invite you to join the conversation by giving us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. And we'll take your calls after this. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're looking at why people who need mental health care, even those with insurance, have a hard time getting it, even in the Bay Area where there are many therapists. We're talking with April Dembosky, KQED's health reporter, Keith Humphreys, professor of psychiatry at the Stanford School of Medicine and a research scientist at Veterans Affairs Palo Alto's healthcare system, and Bart McGee, a psychologist and executive director of Access Institute for Psychological Services, which tries to provide mental health services to those with inadequate insurance. We'd also like like to have you join the conversation. Are you a therapist, an insurer, or someone who's tried to access mental health services? Do these stories reflect your experiences? And what do you think is important for us to know about the state of our mental health services in California? Give us a call with your questions at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. Dan writes, as a practicing psychologist and psychotherapist, I can't help but notice that this problem is the result and consequence of ignorant, quote, progressive policies like the, quote, Unaffordable Care Act, by which patients are forced to get health insurance while therapists shun accepting it because the reimbursement rates are untenable. The more healthcare is managed by the government, the more there are therapist shortages and quality care becomes available to only those who can pay a premium. Keith Humphreys, has the situation gotten worse under the Affordable Care Act?
No, I would say absolutely not. I mean, the Affordable Care Act gives better coverage to over 60 million Americans and, you know, and defines mental health as an essential health care benefit. So, you know, all the problems that April has documented are real, but it is a much better world than it was when I started my career.
And April Domboski, has it gotten any better in terms of access for folks who live in rural areas? That's always been a question, you know, when we look at health services generally.
Yeah, I think, you know, when we talk of a shortage of mental health providers, you see that primarily in rural areas. It's difficult to attract people to live in rural areas, particularly if they're not from there. A lot of the providers that you see are usually from that area. They move away to go to school and then they come back. So in general, you just see a really low number of people living in rural areas who are providing this kind of care.
Well, let's go to Hadi in Redwood City. Hadi, am I saying your name correctly?
Yeah, that's correct. That's my name.
Great. Thanks for joining us. Go ahead.
Yeah, what happened? I'm a psychotherapist. I got licensed in 2011. And my day job is a software engineer. And I cannot actually switch my career if I wanted to. And I love doing programming, and also I love helping people. So what my trying to point out is, it looked like, you know, pointing to the therapist, pointing to the, all of these things. But the fact is, in order for me, I do calculation, in order for me to switch, I am be glad I could support with $70,000 or $60,000, you know, and other stuff. But I cannot do that unless I take a lot more client and even more than full time, which is about 40 hours a week, and that's not sustainable. So I still have to work under my support myself this way.
Well, Hadi, thanks for making that point. You know, April, that reminds me of your story where you, you know, reached out to a doctor who was trying to get into an insurance network. What happened to him?
Exactly. So, you know, there is some survey data actually that shows that, you know, it's, this was a survey of licensed marriage and family therapists, and it found that 41% of them didn't accept insurance because they didn't want to. But there was a small percentage. There was 6% who said they wanted to take insurance but couldn't. And so they would call insurance companies sometimes 10 at a time to see, hey, you know, I want to be part of this system. I want to help lower income people. And the insurance companies will say, oh, sorry, we're full. We're full in your area. And so, yeah, I talked to one psychologist in San Francisco who, you know, applied to 10 insurance companies and only one was willing to accept him. And then even that ended up just not working out for him. The reimbursement rate was even lower than he was expecting. And he realized that the billing for it was going to be so complicated that he'd have to hire somebody to do it. And then that cost calculation just became impossible for him.
Let's go to Chris in Palo Alto. Hi, Chris.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call. So I'm an insurance broker, and you know, I've been doing this for 30-plus years, and I'm also a consumer of mental health. So, you know, I can see both sides. And I personally have been trying to get an appointment to reestablish psychiatric care just to update my medication, et cetera, you know, because I've been on the same dosages for, you know, 10, 12 years. My psychiatrist retired. and I'm trying to go through the network. And, you know, I've just like everyone else, I've been calling and calling and calling. Finally, I got through to an MD, a psychiatrist down here, who told me that it was possible to do what they call a single case accommodation or a single case agreement, where, and your guest can correct me if I'm wrong, but you can go to a private psychiatrist or, you know, one of your choice who's not in network, and the behavioral health plan that the insurance companies contract with are obligated to actually reimburse that person on a single case or a limited case basis, a finite case, not an open-ended therapy course. So that was encouraging, but I have yet to find a psychiatrist who will actually do that. That's number one. And number two, you know, the insurance companies, from the insurance company standpoint, they have what's known as the medical loss ratio. And on individual and family plans, they have to pay out 80 cents of every dollar they take in as premium. They have to pay it out as claims. And so, you know, they're looking to minimize costs, and they subcontract all the mental health care out. You know, the two big providers are Behavioral Health and Magellan. And those reimbursement rates are, as your guests have said, really low. And it's ironic that a physical therapist actually gets a higher reimbursement rate than a psychologist, a clinical psychologist. So that's, I'll take my comments or your comments off the air. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Well, thanks for sharing your story. And Bart McGee, I see you nodding. Is someone like Chris someone you see at Access Institute?
Well, I was just, I was really nodding just because, again, you know, what he brings up is that, yeah, you could do the single case thing, and, you know, but that would require the provider to wrangle with the insurance company. And mm-hmm. again, it just makes it so untenable. And the other thing I keep thinking about is the way we, as a society, are undervaluing mental health care. And, you know, you mentioned this a little bit ago, Geetha, you know, the fact is that we have tons of research that shows that mental health care is integral to physical health. Yet in this kind of medical model, somehow we keep seeing it as some sort of, you know, extra, that it's not essential. You know, that we know that mental health means if you have a mental illness, you're more likely to experience all kinds of physical problems. It shortens the lifespan. I mean, this is really a life and death kind of issue. And so it just, you know, it drives me crazy, this, you know, the way in which we keep, you know, undervaluing it and not supporting it.
You know, Bart McGee, what you're talking about reminds me of another piece that you did, April, on, I think her name was Shariah Roman-Nagy, is that correct? And how, you know, when she tried to access mental health services through her insurer, she was then kind of forced to go out of network and then get into a big fight with her insurer over whether or not any of those payments would be reimbursed because there was a question around medical necessity. And I'd like to play that just briefly for us now.
Everything piled up and piled up and piled up until I just couldn't handle it anymore. So I had my antidepressants and I took a handful of those. But then I thought better of it and I told my mom, and she took me to the emergency room.
There's no adolescent psychiatric hospital in Redding, so Shariah was taken from the local ER to a hospital in Sacramento, an hour and a half to the south. She was there 8 days, and the doctors diagnosed her with bipolar disorder. They said they wanted to keep her longer, but told her the insurance company wouldn't cover it.
I didn't really feel like I was ready because I had just been put on new medications right when I got there. And I was like, in the past, I've had reactions to medications. So I was like, I don't think I'm ready.
After Shariah went home, the hospital helped her find a therapist. But the insurance company said no to that, too. They said the therapist wasn't part of their network.
We spent quite a long time with the insurance company battling them, trying to get them to cover visits with her.
Shariah says the insurer, Anthem Blue Cross, wanted her to see someone on its list of approved in-network providers. At the time, that list was 6 people.
6 total on the list or 6 that were available?
No, there were only like 6 total on the list.
And when she called them, they either said they were full or retired. So Shariah stayed with the out-of-network therapist.
Because at that point, I mean, you're talking, you know, possible life and death issues. And so
that's Shariah's dad, Tom Nagy.
That was my approach, to pay for it, you know, run up the charge cards and things like that.
April Domboski, what can someone do
Who can they turn to if this is happening to them?
Well, there are a couple things. And first, I also just wanted to point out that, I did go to Anthem to get their comment on that case. And actually, Shariah even signed a privacy release to let Anthem discuss the details of her case. And they didn't. They sent a general statement. So we don't, if there are other details that are to be known about what happened there, we don't know. But so it's important to point out that there is a law in California that says that if you are having trouble finding a therapist in your directory, specifically if there are no in-network providers, that the insurance company is required to help you. So as challenging as it may seem at times, you should call your insurance company and ask them for help. There's the out-of-network exception that one of the callers mentioned. And then the other thing to do is, and I've heard this from a lot of advocates, is that they really want people to complain to the state regulator. And California has two state regulators who are charged with enforcing these mental health parity laws. And their work depends largely on consumer complaints. That's how they find out what's going on, and they can investigate. They can help that person in particular perhaps get a denial overturned or help you get the services you need. But it also provides, more data about what's going on in the state.
And Keith Humphries, how is DMHC or the Department of Insurance and Department of Managed Healthcare, how are they at responding to complaints?
Well, as I said, California actually has a better reputation than most states in terms of how they perform in this domain. So I would encourage people to follow April's advice.
The only reason why I ask that is because, there have been complaints that, the Department of Managed Health Care's oversight can be relatively low, that their enforcement efforts can be less than.
Right. So it'd be a question part of how much resource do they have to do these kinds of things. I mean, if you look at the state that really has done this right, it's the state of New York, where it took the state attorney general suing the main insurers on absolutely obvious cases of them breaking the law. And they had to pay a big fine and make public their processes and reform them. And it may be, that an overwhelmed, potentially underfunded state regulator in the end is going to have to be backed up by the top law enforcement official for this to happen the way it should in the rest of the states.
Well, Sue writes, I tried to get my teen help, but I could not find a therapist in our network providing the types of services she needs. I asked for a single case study agreement, but it was denied. I appealed and it was again denied. I appealed to the state and they denied it based on the insurance company providing the names of two therapists that were available. I called those two people three times and they never got back to me. I called the state again to ask if they had confirmed those two therapists and they said no, they had just taken the insurance company's word for it. April Domboski, you're shaking your head.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know what to say.
Well, she should come to Access Institute. We'd help her immediately. But that's the other thing I was just thinking about too, is that we're having all these problems, and half of the people that need mental health care are not getting it. Because that's the other thing. I mean, there are many more people out there that might benefit from it. And, so we're just talking about the people that are asking for it.
Mm-hmm. And I should mention to our listeners, we do have a link to Access Institute on our website, Bart Nagy. Let's go to Dave in San Francisco. Hi, Dave.
Hi. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Go ahead.
Thanks. I'd just like to point out that the insurance company's business is essentially a fraud. Let me give you an example. Many of the graduates of Stanford Medical School who are practicing now in psychiatry are charging about $250 an hour. Somebody like Blue Cross essentially pays $84 of that, of which half is a copay. So essentially they're paying $34. Now, given out of network costs of $9,000, nobody is going to get any health care through Blue Shield. So their offer, of this service is actually fraudulent. If Amazon was doing this, they'd be cited and they'd be prosecuted. Thanks.
Well, Dave, thanks for registering that point. We don't have Blue Shield here. Did you talk with them, especially in the case of the woman who had the $20 copay and couldn't find anybody after six or seven.
Yeah. So I also asked Blue Shield to do an interview, and they declined to do an interview, but they did send a statement. They talked about the shortage. They said they wanted to emphasize that they had 12,000 mental health providers statewide, and that also they, you know, again, emphasizing that it's important for the therapist to let, you know, the insurer know, and that they, you know, do their best to make it easy for them to do that.
Well, I want to thank Dave for the call and go to Lance in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Hi, Lance. Hi, Lance. Are you there? I think we may have lost Lance. Let's try.
I'm sorry?
Oh, Lance, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, great. Hi. Thanks so much for waiting.
Yeah, I've been a therapist for 15 years, and I serve mostly disadvantaged people. I have found that if you charge cash only, let's say that the people do not have insurance, you charge cash. I charge under $50. Most of those people don't even want to pay under $50, despite their urgency, despite their psychopathology, ADHD, depression. They don't want to pay. Okay, if I have an insurance panel, they don't want to pay the copay. They look around my office and say, you know, it looks like you're doing okay, and perhaps their thought is, I'm not going to pay the copay. Now, ethically, I'm not supposed to turn down people who won't pay the copay. So for those who have loans, therapists who have loans for $100,000, well, it's hard to eat when your copays aren't making it and your cash payments aren't making it. So I'll take the response off the air about that.
Yeah, Lance, thanks for making that point. And again, it underscores what you were talking about in terms of therapists just feeling like they cannot survive on the reimbursement rates that insurance companies are offering. Does anyone else want to add anything to that, or let that stand?
I would just put in that, you know, being a therapist is hard work. You know, you really, you know, there was a caller earlier that was saying that he was a software engineer. He'd like to be a therapist, but to do that, you have to like see 40 hours a week. I mean, that's too much. I mean, if we want to provide high quality care, you know, we have to take care of our mental health providers. That's
April Dembowski.
I also got some emails from other therapists in response to some of the stories talking about some different kinds of snafus that they've had getting paid by insurance companies. You know, so sometimes you'll be seeing a patient, they switch jobs, they get a new insurance plan, and now the therapist isn't covered anymore. And so again, you know, that puts the therapist in a difficult position. They have this relationship, you know, do they continue to see them for a lower rate? Also, there have been times when, you know, there's been some kind of insurance change, but the patient themselves doesn't know about it. And so I've heard from some therapists who, you know, the insurance company came back to them 5 months after treatment started and said, actually, we don't cover this patient. We need you to refund 5 months worth of fees. I mean, that's really difficult for a therapist in private practice.
April Dembowski, KQED's health reporter. And you can find a link to April's series on our website, kqed.org/forum. We're also joined by Bart McGee, psychologist and executive director of Access Institute for Psychological Services. That's based here in San Francisco, right, Bart McGee? Yeah. And then Keith Humphreys, professor of psychiatry at Stanford School of Medicine. A listener writes, a way for health providers to save money would be to take advantage of quality group therapy. I saw a psychotherapist for years for bulimia with no headway at all. A 2-month group therapy at Stanford University was what I really needed to get a handle on the eating disorder. Keith Humphreys, when is group therapy a suitable option?
Well, you know, that's a common story you hear. There's many people who find, particularly if they have interpersonal problems, that groups are great because you see the interpersonal interaction right there, and then the therapist can help people understand how they connect with other people. At the same time, there are a lot of people who do not want to be in a group. They feel, you know, ashamed of their condition. They're worried about confidentiality, and they really want that one-on-one relationship. So for them, a group is not going to work.
Well, let's go to Debbie in San Mateo. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have so many things to say about this that I don't even know where to limit my thoughts. But I had a son in the 9th grade that had severe mental breakdown. He was a straight-A honors roll student. But we were with Kaiser at the time. Kaiser had limited amount of visits they would take. This kid probably... he ended up being hospitalized, but I had to try to coordinate care between Kaiser and private care because Kaiser would only give so many visits. And then the private care people didn't want to work with Kaiser because they didn't like what... I had to go through Kaiser for the medication.
Yeah.
And Kaiser didn't want to take medication prescriptions from anybody but their own therapists. So, you know, I ended up in this mess of trying to coordinate all these people that didn't want to work together with a son that was suicidal. But, you know, I think my question is, what is the best course of therapy? How do we reconcile maybe a limited number of visits for someone who needs ongoing help versus a therapist that is in private practice that will keep the therapy going for years because it's, you know, kind of begin to feel like, well, I'm their bread and butter, you know, they want to keep this therapy session going forever and ever. Where's there an end, or when's this kid going to start being independent of his therapist? Because, you know, it's their steady income when they have a patient that goes on for 5 and 6 years.
Debbie, thanks. Barmaki, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I have a couple thoughts about Debbie's question. First of all, she mentioned that her son was hospitalized. And it just makes me think that that's another thing that keeps coming up is that if you don't treat mental illness, it's going to get worse. And then what's the cost, the human cost and the financial cost of hospitalization? Much rather have her son be in long-term therapy. And
that should be an incentive for insurance companies who are trying
to
control costs.
I mean, if we're really thinking at a social level, like if we really want to prevent, you know, increased illness, increased disability, increased death, hospitalization, we should be providing this. The other thing that she was mentioning is this idea that therapists might want to keep their patients. I feel like that's a bit of a myth that's out there. Therapy requires an investment of energy and time. It's a collaboration. I mean, the patient really has to be in therapy. You've got to work at it. And, you know, if you don't have a problem to work on, nothing really happens. So, I mean, I don't know. I just feel like oftentimes that's kind of part of that stigma, the idea that, oh, well, if you provide this, then people are just going to use this thing that they don't really need. I don't see that.
Well, let me thank Debbie for sharing her experience. And Alex writes, I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist in San Francisco. It's not as simple as either providing care for people with serious mental illness or serving the wealthy, quote, worried well. There is a huge spectrum in between, and that is where the vast majority of private practitioners work. Many people have a legitimate mental health diagnosis and a full-time job, a family to support, etc. Another listener tweets, can your guests address the limits of the Affordable Care Act in terms of not forcing insurance companies to control costs or premiums? I was forced to change insurers and basically lose mental health coverage after my premium spiked in 2016. Keith Humphreys, I mean, this comes up again. I mean, you've mentioned that, you know, what's written is quite good. Are there any efforts underway to actually enforce or try to make that more meaningful?
Yeah, I mean, there's a Parity Implementation Coalition, which are a group of, you know, activists who take on cases and try to advocate for people in mental health. There's organizations like, you know, BARDS that sort of tries to fill in the gap for those people who are not getting what they deserve. And there's been some legal action. And I'm also curious what will happen, frankly, after the election, because this is a big issue for a lot of Americans, and whether with a new administration, there'll be more pressure from Washington, as there might well be. I mean, Congress passed these laws. They ought to want to see them enforced.
So, okay, what can be done outside of policy? I mean, what can the person who is needing services, who's calling, who's trying to get it, what can they do in the meantime, Bart McGee? I mean, I know they can go to Access Institute where you will try to find affordable.
Unfortunately, I think what, you know, some of the things that Rachel's talked about is that, you know, I'm sorry, April's talked about is that, you know, they really have to advocate for themselves, unfortunately. I mean, you know, it does take work, and that's tough. But it does take calling. It often takes, you know, advocating for yourself to the insurance company.
Reporting to the state, as we mentioned before.
Reporting to the state. I mean, I think that's and you know, I guess, you know, political action. You know, I think people need to organize.
Anything else, April, that you found in your reporting? Because I'm sure this is just something that, you know, as journalists, you just always want to hit on, okay, where are the solutions?
Well, one of the other things that came up in the reporting is it's – this interesting, it's a different concept but that I wanted to mention. It's something called medical necessity. And so insurance companies, you know, for any kind of health condition are allowed to deny certain treatments if they can determine that it's not medically necessary. But there's a lot of challenge around that when it comes to mental health care because doctors rely a lot on subjective reports about how patients are feeling. And so I just wanted to flag that as that was signaled to me as, you know, this gray area that's where the battleground is really going to, you know, play out even more on some of these issues.
Keith Humphreys, we just have a minute left. I mean, signs of hope out there.
Well, the other group I was going to mention are employers. So, you know, if you are buying health insurance and you're a big company and your employees can't get access to the care that you bought, you're being ripped off. And if someone sold you any other, you know, product or service and you didn't get it, you would get mad and use your influence to advocate. So I'd hope the employers whose employees are getting the runaround would use their considerable influence and put some pressure on to say, hey, you know, stop lying to us. I want to know when I buy it, my employees actually get it.
And Bart McGee, final thoughts from you.
I would say another final thought would be just that, you know, we need more funding. And, you know, just in terms of, you know, large philanthropic organizations, corporate foundations, I think, you know, that just making mental health more of a priority in our country for funding would really, really help the matter.
Psychologist Bart McGee, Executive Director of the Access Institute for Psychological Services in San Francisco, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks also to you, Keith Humphreys, Professor of Psychiatry at Stanford School of Medicine.
Thanks.
And April Demboski, Health Reporter for KQED. Thanks for your series, April.
Thanks for having me.
Reporting on that. And thanks to our listeners for sharing their stories and experiences with us. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, Judy Campbell, and Jeremy Siegel. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from Amanda Font. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our interns are Eli Wolf and Ida Mojadad. And Joanne Wallace is our executive producer. I'm Mina Kim. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.